The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 5 minutes past nine on this Monday, the 10th of July, and you're very welcome along to another edition, another week of the 9 till noon show. I hope you had a lovely weekend, whatever you were doing, if you were able to get out and enjoyed the various events that have started to fill our weekends here now across the Northwest. Let us know what you're up to anyway, and I'll give you the telephone line and the text line, and you can use that for your calls and comments as well. 086 60 25000, that's the WhatsApp and text line from outside the Republic, of course. 00353 86 60 25000. You can give us a call, 07491 25000, or again from outside the Republic, 00353 7491 25000. And feel free to email from anywhere in the world, comments@highlandradio.com. Right, it's another busy Monday morning. Lots to get through today. So let's run through what's on the front of the newspapers this morning and inside some of them, because there's one story again dominating most of the front pages. But we'll start with the locals. The Derry People, Donegal News. Thousands of people took part and viewed what was the largest ever Orange Parade in Rosnala on Saturday, known as the Donegal 12th. According to Donegal County Grand Master David Mahon, there were 53 bands and 70 judges from all across the country which took part in the glorious sunshine. Apart from those taking part in the march and proudly displaying their sashes, thousands turned out to view and enjoy the spectacle as participants made their way from St. John's Parish Church to the beach, a route of around a mile. Speaking to the Donegal News yesterday, Mr. Mahon said the day had been a huge success, which everyone seemed to enjoy. The Derry News this morning tells us that the decision by the Department for Communities to reappoint Capita to carry out assessments for Child Disability Living Alone Allowance has been slammed by local anti-poverty campaigner Sinead Quinn. Capita will also carry out assessment for Personal Independent Payment, Employment and Support Allowances and Universal Credit. Ms. Quinn, who is herself chronically ill and disabled, said it was absolutely despicable. Capita had been awarded a further social security contract in the north. You can read more from her in that interview in the paper today. On to the Irish Times, and this is the story leading all of the papers. Widespread changes in the management of RTE will be unveiled this morning as the new Director General, Kevin Backhurst, promised action after weeks of controversy. Yesterday, the Director of Strategy, Rory Coveney, resigned from his role in order to make way for a fresh lead team within the organisation. Mr. Coveney, who's the brother of Fine Gael Minister Simon Coveney and who was part of RTE's executive management, came under pressure during Oireachtas hearings last week over RTE's decision to run the toy show The Musical Project. He defended the project despite the fact it lost $2.2 million in its first year. Staff will receive an email from Mr. Backhurst this morning, which they have received, outlining his plans to restore trust in the organisation after it emerged that RTE underreported the salary paid to star presenter Ryan Tuberty. He is before Oireachtas committees tomorrow from 11:30. I read elsewhere that pubs are going to be showing it, such as the level of interest. But Mr. Backhurst announced a number of changes which are going to help steady the ship. A new executive, more transparency on wages, and he's made other commitments as well. So maybe it is at the point now, maybe, depending on how tomorrow goes, how this week goes, that is behind them to some extent. The rebuilding process beginning, perhaps. I don't know. But what do you all think? 086 60 25000. There was unsavoury scenes, to say the very least, in County Tyrone at the weekend. I really genuinely find it hard to believe that in 2023 we have adults behaving like this, regardless of what anyone's views or differences are. It just is something I can't get my head around or get any sense of understanding of. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar does not believe the image of his poster being burned on a loyalist bonfire accurately reflected the opinion of the majority of unionists, all Northern Ireland residents, towards the Republic and its leaders. The Police Service of Northern Ireland is investigating the incident in Tyrone on Saturday evening as a potential hate crime. Photographs, videos and social media posts about the construction of the giant bonfire, as well as it being set alight, are being studied by police. A large poster of the Taoiseach was erected on top of an old boat bedecked with two tricolours and placards criticising the Good Friday Agreement. It was then set alight. Now, as I say, I don't care who's doing it about who, but burning people's images and people's flags, I don't know. I can't get my head around it. But a large crowd seemed to enjoy it. They attended the bonfire burning and cheered as it vanished in flames. Speaking in court yesterday, Mr. Varadkar said he was aware of the incident, but did not believe it reflected the opinion of the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland. Well, does it or doesn't it? 00353 86 60 25,000. Or what is the logic, or what's the significance of it? What does it mean? To be putting people's images up. I mean, if you wanted to, the Good Friday Agreement, if you were against that, and you wanted to say it's a sick shimping, a ship sinking and burn the boat, but people's images, people's flags, as I say, I just don't understand. Here's another thing. We're going to be talking about this a little later on as well. A ban on phone and smart devices at schools, thanks to Parent Power, should be rolled out across the country. It was demanded last night. Parents and principals of eight schools in Greystones, County Wicklow, banned smartphones, tablets and other devices among children until they hit secondary school age. And their successful no smart device voluntary code should be rolled out nationwide, according to Senator Mary Seary Kearney, who will join us later, as I mentioned. The code saw parents agreed to ban smartphones, smart pads and access to age-inappropriate apps such as Snapchat, Instagram, WhatsApp, TikTok and Discord. Many parents, said the senator, have a lot of concerns about their child's well-being and safety when they allow them to use smart devices, she added. So would it be easier? Because it's difficult as a parent. You would know, wouldn't you? Because they say, please, 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 please. Such and such has one, such and such has one, such and it gets difficult. You know, it's and life is tough, very tough at times. And, you know, you try and work through everything and you go, right, OK, you know, but you can't do this and you can't do that. It would help. I think it would help is, look, they're banned in schools. No one can take it to school. That's just the way it is. It might make it easier for parents. Are you for or against such an idea? As I say, we'll be talking about it in a little bit more detail later, but maybe you want to get your opinion in right now. 086 60 25,000. In the Irish Sun, we read that most 13-year-olds are healthy, have made the move to secondary school well and feel supported. This according to new research and seems like good news on the face of it. This is despite those children being born in 2008 and growing up during their formative years in a recession. The Department of Children's Growing Up in Ireland report added their middle childhood would have seen major social changes in Ireland, such as the marriage equality referendum, and they've grown up in a time of significant technological changes. More than 6,000 children aged 13 and their caregivers were interviewed for the government study. The survey examined how their life has changed since they were being interviewed at the age 9. Under the topic of education, the department said the vast majority of the 13-year-olds had made the transition to secondary school and 97% agreed they had made new friends. Okay, which is positive, doesn't it? It seems positive. The RTE have their issues. BBC also are at the currently are in the throes of a controversy. The BBC has suspended the high-profile presenter accused of paying a teenager £35,000 sterling for sexual images and has reported the allegations to the police. This is in the Irish Daily Star and it's all over British media, primarily on the BBC. The alleged victim, now 20, was reportedly 17 when they first started receiving payments for sending the explicit pictures. The scandal is rumoured to involve one of the BBC's most senior, highly paid stars, who's a household name. Gary Lineker and Rylan Clark are among the BBC presenters who publicly stated they were not the star in question, which Lineker tweeted, "Hate to disappoint the haters, but it's not me." And this is the kind of problem, well, not the kind of problem, a real problem with social media, particularly Elon Musk's incarnation of it in that. And the mainstream media too, not innocent in this, is that as soon as the person was anonymised, everyone was speculating as to who it was or who they hoped it might be. The person seems to have pretty much been named now on social media, though not publicly, and it is a shocker. There's just no doubt about it. But as I say, Rylan Clark also declared, "Not sure why my name's floating about, but read that story. That ain't me, babe, he said. Jeremy Vine also said it wasn't he. Following the suspension of the star at the centre of the scandal, questions still remain over why it had taken so long for any action by the BBC to take place after the complaint was made 7 weeks ago on May 19th. But as I say, it's a huge scandal across the water. And the person who is accused is entitled to their privacy. But that just means that the speculation continues as to who it might be, which is kind of unfair on everybody else, isn't it? But I don't know how they're going to square that circle there. And lastly, in the Irish Daily Mirror, the justice system is being forced to compensate criminals for not protecting them while they serve their jail sentences. It's been revealed that the prison service is facing a bill of up to, wait for it, €56 million in compensation claims from prisoners and others. The Oireachtas Public Accounts Committee has been told that 1,007 claims have been made, each worth more than €50,000 in average. Dublin's Mountjoy Prison has by far the highest potential liability, with 389 claims outstanding, which could cost the taxpayer over €14 million. I mean, this is really, in a way, a bigger controversy than the other one. Next highest is Portlaoise Prison, where there have been 102 claims, which, if successful, could hit the state for nearly €13 million. But I suppose the key piece of information there is, if successful, but the bill, €56 million in compensation for prisoners. We're all doing it wrong, really. We should not pay our TV licence, go to prison and sue and come out much better off all round, perhaps. That's a joke, by the way. I'm not for a moment suggesting that perhaps you should be. More than 1,000 people were treated at the country's 6 sexual assault treatment units last year. The latest annual report of the HSE-funded units also reveal a growing trend of the use of extreme violence in assaults. The centres are located in Letterkenny, of course, Dublin, Cork, Waterford, Mullingar and Galway. We're joined on the programme now by Nolene Blackwell of the Rape Crisis Centres. Good morning to you, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Nolene, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Greg.
Looking at the figures, what's your initial reaction? I mean, it's important we get that information out there so people know what's going on. 1,072 people were treated at the country's 6 sexual assault treatment units last year. That's a significant increase on 2021. But what about, say, 2019? Perhaps maybe there was that might be a figure that gives us a better idea of what's happening.
Yeah, actually, it is really, I think it is. There was a bit of a dip during COVID for a number of reasons, probably. Hospitals were harder to access. People weren't going out as much. And there was a certain element whereby people were a bit reluctant sometimes to look for help if they'd been out socialising, where perhaps it wasn't socially acceptable or even legal at the time. So 2019 is a really, it probably is a better indicator. But even from that, the figures are up 10% on what they were in 2019. And I think, Greg, it might be worth just saying what the sexual assault treatment units are, because of the 1,000 plus who were seen in 2022, over about 11% of them, so over 100 people were seen in Letterkenny. And these are specialised units attached to 6 of the country's hospitals, where people can go after a rape or other sexual assault and get medical help, you know, just check out, check for possible sexually transmitted disease, look for emergency contraception if they need it, look for other medical help. And it's also a place where these specialised units know how to collect evidence for forensic purposes. So if there was to be evidence needed for a court case later, they would pick that up. Mm. So they're highly specialised units, and they're a great thing to have. And in all of the various centres, including in Letterkenny, there's support available from the Rape Crisis Centre. So Donegal Rape Crisis Centre supports people who go to that if they want it at the time and afterwards. And they are there specifically to give that help, but they also give us this really valuable information about the numbers of people who contact them.
Yeah, and also too, and we've said it before, worth reiterating that it's obviously best to go to one of these centres as soon as you can, but it doesn't necessarily trigger a train of a train of events, i.e., you know, court cases and all that type of stuff. In the first instance, you know, it's about the treatment and care, yeah, and the gathering of information or evidence if required.
Yeah, and they can store that evidence.
Yes.
You know, if somebody is, some people will be absolutely clear. They'll have come to the centre through the Gardaí, and they want the evidence collected for the Gardaí. But some people will not be so sure. And all the units can store the evidence, normally for up to a year, a little bit longer if necessary. But often people look for that evidence maybe 2, 3, 6 months later, or they will tell the guards to go ahead. Mm. So it's really useful. You don't have to make these big decisions on the night. You just have to look out for yourself.
But just so it's clear for everyone, because the location or how you access, the location would be made aware once you begin to engage. It might not be very clear to people generally. It's only maybe in a crisis that you might need to know. So if someone is the victim of this type of a crime, and in the first instance they're not ready to speak to the guards, or they don't fancy turning up to the ED, how are you referred to, or what is the pathway to actually getting to one of these crisis centres?
And so there's a number of pathways. So a lot of people come through the Gardaí. So they report the assault, including the rape, to the Gardaí,
okay,
and the Gardaí will direct them. This is really only useful, to be honest, if it's within a short enough time of the rape. So if it's over, the longest time that they seem to have recorded last year was a month. They like to see people as quickly as possible, preferably certainly within a week, because evidence deteriorates over time. So a lot are referred by the Gardaí. Some are referred by local rape crisis centres or by the National 24-Hour Helpline. So a small percentage are referred that way. A lot of people find it themselves. It is possible to go to these centres yourself and just turn up, and they will deal with you as well.
Mm. It's any assault is worrying. Any increase is particularly worrying. But this increase in violence in sexual assaults, I mean, have we learned anything? Do we know why this might be happening? Why we're seeing this trend? Because it's something we can't ignore, nor should we ever.
We can't ignore it. It is increasing. It is consistent with what those who deal with sexual assault victims in therapy circumstances and in the guards, it's consistent with what they're seeing and hearing as well, is that extreme violence, gratuitous violence, restraints are increasing in the number of assaults that are presenting. And the SATU, these units, are very good at collecting it. So there's probably a number of reasons. There are people who are abusive and malicious. So in the context of domestic violence, we know physical violence is a part of it, and domestic violence can often be sexual violence. There is also a worrying increase in the number of people who are getting most of their information about what's normal in a sexual relationship through pornography. Mm. And alas, most pornography that people are accessing is abusive. And so that is leading to violence that the people involved in the relationship think this kind of violence is normal or necessary in a relationship, rather than recognizing it as abusive in advance.
Yeah. And before we talk about maybe what needs to be done from a government perspective in terms of, you know, how quickly people are seen and what have you, I don't know. I've never really sat down and really, really, really thought about it. But you would imagine, with all the conversations we have, with all the awareness, that in 2023 we'd be seeing a retraction in things. You know what I mean? That things wouldn't be getting worse. And it's primarily still, overwhelmingly, in terms of who presents at these clinics, it's women. So women are more likely now to be the victims of sexual abuse. And not only that, there is a growing trend that there is a violent nature to that sexual abuse. Like, we aren't making improvements. We're going backwards.
I wonder, because part of it could be that there's an increase in sexual violence. It could be also that people are more ready to come forward. Mm. So if more people are reporting to the guards, it's inevitable that more people will be going to SATUs. There is a huge under-reporting in this area, so it's probably a good thing that people are reporting, are getting the help they need. And people really, a great way of working out whether you need it is to go to the guards or to go to your rape crisis centre. DonegalRapeCrisis.ie or the National Helpline are great resources. I have to leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. I know you've got another appointment to do. Appreciate your time. That is Nolene Blackwell, who is the CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. And that organisation are calling on the government to do a number of things in relation to victims of sexual assault. SATU across Ireland have failed to reach their targets of seeing victims within 3 hours of requesting an examination. Ms. Blackwell said in her press statement that usual situations with so many health services at the moment as on social nighttime hours make it difficult to staff the treatment units. Nolene has said the long wait times can be incredibly hard for victims because, of course, they're already upset by rape or sexual assault. And while they're waiting for their treatment, they can't go home and change or what have you. So they're looking for government support to assist in that regard. 086 60 25 000 if you wish to make a comment there. Caller says, shocking to see RTE run an item on the news last night telling us that pubs are showing Ryan Tubridy's evidence. They're trying to justify the spending of the TV licence fee, and this is what we get, encouraging the public to rush to the pub. Shocking stuff. I think really it's more reactionary that some pub owners are seeing it as a way to attract in clients. The reporting on it as such, I'm not sure they'd be encouraging it, but I respect your point of view and thank you for it. A caller says, not sure what Mr. McMahon considers a successful parade. I believe the displaying of Union Jacks at the parade was nothing short of a disgrace. We've tolerated this sectarian group marching in our country. Think it's now time to stop this march. Not sure there's a massive appetite for it to stop, but anyway. I believe I can say good morning now to Senator Lisa Chambers. Are you there, Lisa?
Morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Great to have you on board. Thanks for joining us. I said this on the programme a couple of times, just going around the Northwest, it just does not seem to be as busy as it was. And talked to some people in the tourism industry, they suggest that there is an issue with people visiting. A, there is a sense that maybe some sectors are pricing themselves out of it, but B, a lot of accommodation is being tied up. Tourist accommodation is being tied up to house refugees. This is something that you want worked on. Too late perhaps for this year, but certainly as we look forward to 2024.
Yeah, definitely. I do think it's an issue, particularly for our part of the country, the West and the Northwest, and actually down as far as in Kerry as well, in Clare and Galway, all along the Western seaboard, really. There's a lot of hotel accommodation, predominantly the budget hotels, the 2 and 3 star hotels, the guest houses. They have been, a lot of that accommodation has been taken up to house refugees. It was, I suppose, the easy option because the numbers coming in were just extraordinary, much more than we've ever experienced ever really in the history of the state. We're probably upwards now, including Ukrainian refugees, probably around the 100,000 mark with everybody. So look, we had to house people somewhere, and hotels were, particularly towards the end of last year, because, you know, Donegal, Sligo, Mayo, our tourism season doesn't really kick in until kind of Easter, and it kind of, you know, closes up usually around the October time. So we had a lot of vacancy in this region around that time. And so it was the easy option. Now, every part of the country, every county is housing refugees. But for our part of the country, Donegal, for example, I think it's about 50% of Fáilte Ireland registered accommodation is now occupied with refugees. In Mayo, I think we're at about 35%. Longford is 70%. So it varies. Some counties are, I suppose, have a higher occupancy than others. But then some counties would have had, you know, more bed nights or more rooms. So Longford would have been coming from quite a low base. It wouldn't have had that many rooms anyways. But just to give a comparison of where we're at. Now, I've raised this. I actually scheduled a debate in the Shannon in May of this year, so 2 months ago, with the Tourism Minister, Catherine Martin, specifically to raise this issue with her. So I said, look, you know, I understand, and I think people understand, we had to do what we had to do to help people that were fleeing war, and hotel accommodation was the obvious place to house people. But we need a plan now for next year. I think this tourism season is already impacted. And it's not the hotels that are housing refugees are doing very well. They're getting paid very, very well. But it's the ancillary businesses, the related businesses. So your pubs, your coffee shops, your restaurants that rely on those hotels and guest houses having tourists. They're the ones that are now feeling the pinch because they don't have the same numbers of tourists in the area simply because there is nowhere for people to stay. And you mentioned, Greg, about the cost of what is available. It's connected because the fact that there's less accommodation available, the demand is still there. And so the price goes up. So there are some hotels across the country that are absolutely price gouging and charging astronomical rates. I don't know who's paying it, but they seem to be getting it. Yeah. But that's part of the problem because there isn't enough accommodation to serve the demand that's there, not just for Irish holidaymakers staycationing around the country, but for tourists coming in from, you know, the UK or America or Europe, mainland Europe that want to come and visit. And we would get a lot of tourists in the West and Northwest from Germany, from France, that like the wild aspect of Ireland, you know, coming to Western.
It's kind of difficult, Lisa, in that, you know, we could have been critical of sort of the cities or particularly Dublin as the gateway to the rest of the country often, that, you know, maybe when people land and they see the prices there, they don't really get that if you travel a wee bit into the west, into Mayo, Roscommon, Sligo, Donegal, that you can get really good value. But we're missing a trick on that now because obviously there's so much accommodation that's not there. And what is there is really quite expensive, though there are some deals to be had. But if this continues, there's a reputation that we could get that would be hard to shift. You know, that's why really we don't need it running into another year or a year after that, because we could lose a reputation as a place where you can afford to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, Greg, if you actually, you know, take away the nights where you might have a big concert on in Dublin or a big sporting event in Dublin, you'd probably get a cheaper hotel in Dublin than you will in Killarney or Westport, for example. You know, like the cost of hotels now in some of the big tourist destinations in Donegal and Mayo and Kerry are very expensive. So it's just not affordable for most families that might be visiting from other parts of Ireland. So I do think it's an issue. The minister is aware of it. I spoke to her in the chamber in May. I had a conversation with her after we'd finished the statements, you know, just one to say, look, what's the plan here? She has assured me she is engaging with Roderick O'Gorman because obviously it's his department that have a policy of using hotels, but Catherine Martin is the minister responsible for tourism. So the two departments need to work together and obviously all of government as well. And I think there is, people have been very welcoming and very good natured and they understand the pressures and the need to house people that are fleeing awful situations. But what the hospitality sector are looking for now, and I've engaged a lot with Fáilte Ireland on this just to get the statistics, the numbers, the data to back up the points that I've been raising. And they too, in fairness to Fáilte Ireland, they have raised this directly with government. They've published a report on it and they are highlighting it as well. So there is an expectation from the sector that we would certainly have a plan in place for 2024 and beyond. We can't allow this policy to bed in and become the norm. And look at, you know,
the problem is just only say, if you don't mind, just to cut across you. I mean, listen, you know, most people feel we had to do what we had to do. OK, but to some extent, we've created the problem ourselves as well, because as you would know, I'm sure around your area, I would know from the around here is a lot of these hotels. People have been staying in them for quite some time. There's no alternative accommodation, particularly in the tourist areas around. You know, people have bedded into the communities. You know, some children will be starting their second year of education in the local school. It's going to be very difficult to sort this out now for those reasons, because we've seen what's happened on the one or two few occasions where we try and move you know, people from one area to the next. It simply doesn't happen for many reasons. They don't like it, and locals who cherish them in their communities now don't like it, and as I say, the children being in school. And I'm thinking of three or four examples. Where would that accommodation actually be locally? I just think this is going to be a really difficult problem to fix. As I say, I like to be optimistic, but I just can see the problems here.
No, it is. There's no point in saying otherwise, Greg. It's going to be a challenge to fix it. The plan was, or I think it still is, it's to provide a modular accommodation in those communities, because we don't want people to leave our communities. You're right. You know, we've had thousands of Ukrainian refugees come into Donegal and my own county of Mayo as well. You know, they're part of our community. They're working here locally. Their kids are in school. And you see the pushback from local people when there has been attempts to move people. You know, it must be absolutely terrifying to leave your home country, to try and resettle into a new community, to be asked to do that a second time or a third time and move around just isn't, we can't do that to children that are fleeing war. We have to look after people. But at the same time, we shouldn't create a second problem in terms of damaging our hospitality and tourism industry, because, you know, all along the Western region, it's a big, big employer for us in the part of the country where we live. You know, you take away some of the multinationals that we have, you know, the factories we might have in different parts. Outside of that, hospitality and tourism are major, major employers, and they're, you know, they're paying the bills in many households. So we have to protect that industry that we've spent decades building up.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, well in advance, you know, I was saying this back in May, well in advance, we are flagging that for next year, we need to see some sort of plan to try and get at least some of that accommodation back into the system. And I can see in my own part of the country, you know, there are certain individuals in a small number that are speculating on accommodation that ordinarily would become tourist accommodation and would add to our bed stock. But now they're going straight for working with IPAS and working with the Department of Integration because it's so lucrative.
Yeah,
it's very hard to compete. If you're weighing up your options and you have accommodation, you know, if you're housing refugees, straight away you've got full capacity 24/7. You can plan your staff, you can plan your food orders. It's a much easier business model than trying to, you know, deal with the seasonal tourism that we usually cater for.
And I think it's very useful, Lisa, you speaking out in this, because it's a difficult one. Finally, I won't hold you much longer. It's a difficult one to speak about because, you know, say, for instance, a local business owner who's sending staff home because it's quiet. They probably know the person that's running the hotel, or they don't want to be seen to be anti-refugee. So they're probably struggling in silence to some extent, you know, at least public silence. So I think it's useful for the likes of yourself to give them a voice, because I can imagine it's a difficult one. You know yourself, you can imagine the small area, and if you start talking about it, you know, it could very easily be turned against you and you could be cancelled or something along those lines. You know where I'm coming from?
We're in a world now where you could say something, it can be taken up wrong or misinterpreted. But I suppose, you know, I'm in elected politics more than a decade now. People know me pretty well, I think. I try and be balanced and reasonable, and I think it's, people will know from my commentary in the last year, I'm clearly not anti-refugee, and I'm very proud of our country for what we've done to help people, and we need to continue to do that. But it's important that these issues that are affecting ordinary people on the ground in the communities that we represent, that we don't leave that to the hard left or the hard right, that the middle ground, you know, the middle ground politicians need to also address these issues. Otherwise, we will create problems. So at least, you know, I'm engaging with hotels and restaurants in my own area. Spoken to one hotelier, he just said to me, look, there's bus tours that aren't coming into the region this summer because the hotel accommodation isn't there. And, you know, people might say, oh, what's the big deal about a bus tour? But every single bus that might have 50 people on it, they might spend €50 each in the local area. The tourism, you know, the souvenir shop or the coffee shop, collectively, that's a lot of money to
indeed. I think it's €1 spent in hotels, €3 in the community. I can't remember. I think that's what I read. Okay, Senator, thanks for your time this morning. We'll see how things progress. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg.
Bye-bye. Take care. That's Fianna Fáil Senator Lisa Chambers there. Maybe you are in business and you are feeling what Ms. Chambers, Senator Chambers, is talking about. Let us know. 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or call us 07491 25000. Of course, it says, Greg, please warn people to double and triple check the scam messages of, hey, mum, I lost my phone. I'm using a friend's. Can you transfer me money? I was almost caught sending my son €1,000 this week because we panic, don't we? Okay, son, what can I do? So just have some sort of system in place where you can double check with a young person. Those texts, they send millions of them out. They only need 3 or 4 people to fall for it. So please be really careful, according to that listener. Greg mentioned about Newtown Cunningham Main Street and that it has many cars needed maintaining, and it's a shame and disgrace, and the council should be ashamed of themselves. Okay, what is that? Is the Main Street in Newtown Cunningham in a bad situation? Is that what the listener's saying? Well done to the Car and Donna traders on a visit to Car and Donna Festival from Thursday to last night from Car and Donna. Okay. There's a cow out in the road between Cranford and Carrigart, by the way, so be careful if you're in that area. So a ban on phones and smart devices at school, thanks to Parent Power, should be rolled out across the country. It was called for last night. You may have heard in the news over the weekend, Senator Mary Ciri Kearney of Fine Gael, who's a spokesperson on children. Senator, good morning to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Hello, good morning.
Now, I'm sure you've polled people around you. You know, we've seen the success in other areas. And, you know, before you float ideas like this, you do your research and you chat to people. And there's a very little pushback to this, because this, in a way, makes a caregiver's lives a little bit easier, doesn't it? You know, when something's mandated, it means that it's not our fault. Do you know what I mean? It just makes it slightly yes. easier. So talk to me a little bit about you as to why you've proposed this.
Well, I did poll, and to be sure of this sort of buy-in, because to successfully implement a ban on mobile phones for all primary school children, you need the buy-in of parents, teachers, but you also need to buy in at state level to support that impact, because it's much easier to say, but sure, I can't, you're not old enough, love. Isn't that an easier way to say it? But it's really important that we get that collaboration, and it's really important for children. And I suppose here is why. Children buried in a mobile phone are missing developmental stages. They're missing that interaction with other children, the play of their imagination, that even the hustle and bustle of the schoolyard are out playing. That's lost when children have a head buried into a mobile phone. So it's not good for themselves. Then on top of that, we obviously have the exposure of bullying and the potential bullying that has had fatal consequences in many instances, and near misses in others. So it strips away the childhood of children. And so I believe this is part of bringing back childhood, bringing back that protected time of innocence, and that we need to say, you know what, it's not appropriate for children under the age of 13, you know, going into secondary school, anyone prior to that in primary school, they shouldn't have mobile phones.
Yeah.
And I think that push for one starts at Holy Communion.
Yeah, for sure. And we'll tease that out a little bit, because, you know, as us as the adults, it's all right going saying we need to do something, or this isn't right, or there's pressure on children, but we actually have to take responsibility and say, all right, well, what can we as a collective group of adults do to help our children? And I think this is sort of one of those things. So what has happened where this has been done on a voluntary basis elsewhere in Ireland? And of course, there are other countries too that have introduced something on a national level. So what are the models out there, and what would you like to see employed here?
Well, from a perspective at home, we've seen in Greystones and in Dingle, we've seen schools implemented with a code of conduct and an agreement, almost a parents' charter that says no one is going to have a mobile phone in this school. That way is very successful, because no child has or hasn't. There's no in-group and out-group. Everybody is exactly the same. They might have it outside of school, but they certainly don't have it in the school where the most peer pressure maybe is happens and occurs. In Netherlands last week, we saw that they brought in from a state perspective, they brought in that the use of smart devices was not, other than those that are mandated in the classroom, that they were not permissible now, because they feel that they are a distraction, they undermine concentration and focus on children in secondary school and young people in secondary school. So where it happens and you have that collaborative buy-in, it's very successful and implemented. It doesn't stop the outside of school. So in a way, we need probably to have a national conversation. You know, my daughter goes swimming on a Friday evening. Oftentimes, the parents along the swimming bank are all have their heads in a mobile phone. And it may be for good reasons. I know sometimes my husband, he's catching up in his emails. But there is we're losing that connection of watching this stage of development, engaging with our children. So maybe we need to start modeling it ourselves.
Exactly. And practice what we preach.
Our own screen time.
Okay. So this seems like there should be a broad buy-in. You've reached out to a few people. Is this a complicated thing to, like, is this a legislative situation? Is it a sort of a national guideline that the schools can say to parents, look, at these are national guidelines? Because I want to talk a little bit about the parents that won't like this as well. But so how would we in this country, if we were to do this on a national basis, what would it look like in terms of, would it be a recommendation? Would it be a mandate? Is it something legislative? I don't know.
Well, I think there are a few elements to that. First, from a school perspective, it would be much easier for schools and parents if there was a circular from the Department of Education. So I think we need to get around the table and have a discussion about that, and making sure that that that's the right thing, that it's all right. In my view, it is the right thing for us to do, and we need to just go for it. I've rebelled over, you know, I remember my first mobile phone, it came free with my AA membership. So that's how long ago that was. But as you've grown, our culture has changed. How we our convenience, everything about how we interact in the world has changed. And it's led by social media companies, it's led by, you know, private mobile phone companies selling us all these devices, rather than actually as a society of saying, is this okay? Are we doing this right? You know, I have that band at the bottom of my email that says, if you're opening this outside of a time that you're not working, that's okay. I'm sending it because it's the time that I'm working. So there are a number of societal things that we need to challenge and we need to talk about. I think it's easier if it's led by government. It's easier if it comes from in schools, if it comes from the Department of Education in the form of a circular. Then, in a way, for the parents who don't want to buy in, it's mandated by the department. And for those who do, they have that, I suppose, license to say, well, this is right. I believe in this. And actual fact, it's been being supported by the government. I think we can often use mobile phones as pacifiers. You know, you'll see young children at the table out in restaurants and coffee shops, and they have a mobile phone.
That's the only way you can get into the coffee. That's the problem. It's the only way you can get into the coffee shop is to give them the bloody phone. So that was set at home.
Indeed, but there maybe was a time when we'd give them
No, we didn't. We stayed at home.
We do all that.
We
you know?
Stayed at home. No, I do take your point. I do indeed. I don't think they've got a voice yet, but invariably they will. There's going to be parents and guardians that's going to be pushback on this. For there'll be very good reasons as to why. You know, maybe it's
yes, Craig. Why? Yeah, what are those good reasons?
It could be, I don't know, shared guardianship or something. Do you know what I mean? Or making. I heard that such and such. What if the bus doesn't pick them up? And do you know that? Like, I mean, we will hear that. But there comes a point whereby you can't please everyone all of the time, that you have to sort of say, well, what is just the best thing? Because we scrutinize and analyze and argue everything down to the point sometimes where nothing happens at all. We need to start making, I think, you know, what are on the face of it broadly welcome logical decisions. I think we need to have the courage to actually start making those decisions, both as, you know, as citizens and as legislators.
Yes, and in a way, if we think about some of the arguments are that supervision, access to children, but actually, are we disempowering their own sense of responsibility and ability to get buses, that we have to micromanage them, know where they are at all times to that extent? You know, if they're familiar with bus routes, if they're cycling, you know, if something happens, there's always an adult with a phone nearby who would always oblige. You know, that things like that don't happen, that people don't say no in a case of an emergency. So I think there are accessibility. If a message has to be gotten to a child through school, there's the staff office. So I think there are ways we buy into convenience and the easiest way of living our lives. And that's a symptom of...
Maybe we also need maybe not to be so fearful. We're turning into and it's a wider conversation, which I won't bore you with, of course, but, you know, just about our resilience, and not only our resilience, but our children's resilience and our fear and the comfort it gets from my umbilical cord extending as far as the national school. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes that needs to be.
And I suppose I trained as a counselling psychologist and have read a lot of books, particularly when I became a parent myself. I'm thinking, oh God, you know, I don't want to mess this up. That sometimes you might get hurt is about the parents' anxiety.
Of course,
and not about, and actually the message we need to give to children is things like this happen. We will get through this and we will overcome it. So there is something in that, in the manner in which we just allow mobile phones. Yeah. We don't think about it, because there's tracking on it. We can contact them all the time. They can contact us all the time. But actually, we need to challenge that culture, what we're doing. And you're absolutely right, Greg. You know, you're really.
And children only contact you when they need something anyway. They don't just randomly message. How are you? Are you getting on all right? You know, as soon as it beeps.
As soon as it beeps, the ATM machine. Yeah, and taxi.
Can you send me €10? Sod off. Okay. He's only three. No, I'm only joking. All right, Senator, thanks for your time. We'll see how this progresses. All right, take care of yourself. Senator Mary Seary Kearney there of Fine Gael, spokesperson on children. As I say, on the face of it, it seems like a really logical thing to do, a great equaliser. But as I say, there are people that are probably going to come up with really decent arguments as to why it's not a good move. I don't know. Right, to some of your comments as we head towards news at 10. Having worked for one of the world's biggest hotel brands, says this listener, I'm aware that hotel pricing rates increase as the percentage occupancy increases. So the more rooms are booked, the higher the price of the remaining rooms. So essentially, our hotel prices are being inflated by the permanent residency of refugees in our hotels. This false inflation of pricing is destroying our tourism industry and all of the ancillary businesses it supports. Hotels have become secondary direct provision centres. Another caller says, morning, Greg. To hear Lisa Chambers say that there's almost 100,000 extra people in Ireland is almost unbelievable. Yes, it's affecting tourism, but on a much wider scale and more alarming is there isn't one extra school place or extra hospital bed or GP. This really can't go on. Or can it? Not sure about what the impact on schools are. I think quite a few rural schools have appreciated the boost in numbers as it relates to access to GPs and hospital cares. Anecdotally, you hear that there are pressures there, of course, as well, though most of the people here are young and healthy. Can it go on? You have to increase resources, I suppose. Continuing these parades is only continuing the conflict for generations to come by celebrating violence and war, says the listener. Another, Lisa, is exactly right, but as usual, they're far too late. They spent millions on Wild Atlantic Way, and it was actually working. They've undone all that in the last year or two. Far too much money in housing Ukrainians, some people making all the money from this to the detriment of the tourism industry. But again, if you're in the tourism industry, either inside or outside the hotel element of it, have you noticed thing, maybe it's busier than ever this year, or maybe your business is not quite as busy as it was previously. You don't have to say specifically where you are. We're not looking to cause any angst more amongst businesses in local communities, but it would be really interesting to get that insight. I was in Donegal on Saturday while in a pub. A band came in while en route to Rosnala. There was a lot of singing of loyalist songs and effing the IRA. No one management approached them to ask them to stop. Many people eating and drinking, including ourselves, left as they felt uncomfortable. How is this showing respect? I don't know. I mean, that happens. I'm not defending it, but just on the flip side, I was in a pub a couple of weeks ago and there was a chance of Sinn Féin and IRA. You know the song, by the way. I'm not saying it was Sinn Féin supporters, or I'm not getting into any of that, but you know there's a song, Fields of Athenry, I believe it is, and if there was anyone of a different religious background in that place, they probably would have felt uncomfortable too. Good old bigotry and sectarianism is still alive in the north of Ireland. One section of the community have moved on while the other half is stagnated in 1690. Bowler hats, sashes, flutes and drums. Their cohorts want to trample on the Catholic people of Garvey Road, they say. Great to see Donegal showing respect to the Orange Order Parade in Rosnala. Pity the same wasn't returned to our Taoiseach in Northern Ireland, says a listener. Is it acceptable that a sitting government minister has a brother sitting on the board of an independent national broadcaster? Surely the public should be made aware of these appointments. I also think that Dee Forbes should not be CEO of GEA Go while she's DG of a business that buys services from the GEA. For instance, she can decide to make a very important match pay-per-view knowing it will generate more money for the GEA. Is it not a conflict of interest? Well, she's no longer a director of GEA Go, but of course, you know, riding two horses, not ideal. We're a small enough country. I suppose if you've got people that get to the top, say two brothers or brothers and sisters or two sisters, there's always potential for a conflict, isn't there, of conflict of interest. I see exactly where you're coming from. I don't know what the solution is. All right, stay where you are. We will be back with more after the news and obituary notices.